Morning, the Sanity 12 Budget Division will come to order. Today is Thursday, February 26, 2015. We have five bills before us. First is Senate File 398, Senator Dietzick on Collaborative Urban Education Program. Welcome to the committee, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing Senate File 398, the Collaborative Urban Educator Recruitment and Training Program. The Minnesota Department of Education submitted a report to the legislature earlier this year that stated 25% of our student populations are student of color, and that number is expected to grow. Our teacher workforce is only around 4% people of color. Studies confirm teachers of color positively impact academic outcomes for students of color in the areas of attendance, standardized test scores, advanced level course enrollment, and college enrollment rates. The Collaborative Urban Education Recruitment and Training Programs funded by this bill help increase the number of teachers of color. Augsburg College, Concordia University, Hamline University, and the University of St. Thomas are training and working to retain culturally competent, highly qualified teachers who can bridge many cultures and produce students who are able to compete and thrive in today's global economy. These programs are responding to the need for teachers who reflect the greater racial and ethnic diversity we have across our state. I have a lot of testifiers with me today to support the program, so I will let them speak, and then we can answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Dietzick. Welcome to the testifiers for the tape. If you can please state your name and who you're representing.
Thank you, Chairman Wieger and members of the committee. My name is Doug Hannes. I am Vice President for University and Government Relations at St. Thomas. At the outset here, I'm going to speak on behalf of the programs at St. Thomas, Concordia, Hamline, and Augsburg that have benefited from grants that they've received from the legislature. I'll provide an overview on those programs, and then you'll hear from representatives of each program. I want to thank you and the committee for your past support of our efforts to educate more teachers of color. I also want to thank Governor Dayton and the Education Department for recommending continued funding in the next two fiscal years, and I want to thank Senator Dietzick for authoring the bill. So you might be wondering why these programs are necessary. Bottom line is that the teacher workforce composition has not kept up with classroom diversity in Minnesota. A report last week from Educators for Excellence pointed out two things. One, 25% of students in Minnesota are students of color. And two, only 4% of teachers are teachers of color. It's really critical for students of color to learn from teachers with the same background, culture, and life experience. So what do we do? Well, our four institutions began programs to specifically educate more teachers of color. St. Thomas, Hamline, Concordia, and Augsburg are really at the forefront of expanding diversity of the teaching ranks in Minnesota. We believe our programs are innovative, they're complementary, and they work together very well. We recruit, train, and retain teachers from diverse racial and ethnic backgrounds, as you'll see this morning. And our programs really fit beautifully in the missions of our institutions. St. Thomas began its Collaborative Urban Educator Program in 1991 and expanded it in 1997 with legislative funding. It's a post-baccalaureate program. This year, there are 43 students who will receive their special ed or ESL licenses and will be placed in public school districts. That will bring our number of alumni from the program to 429. 75% are still in education today. 80% are teachers of color, and most of these people will go on to get their graduate degrees, their master's degrees. Concordia St. Paul began its Southeast education program in 1998 with legislative funding. It's a bachelor's degree and teacher licensure program that targets people who work in various capacities in as non-licensed teachers in our schools. There's more than a dozen students this year, and they have 125 alumni who are teaching. Hamline began its Center for Excellence in Urban Teaching in 1996 and expanded it in 1997 with legislative funding. The program supports teachers in their critical first 3 years in urban or urban-like districts. There are 56 teachers in the Urban Education Certificate Program this year, and there's been more than 1,000 that have gone through the program since 1997. And Augsburg began its East African student-to-teacher program 2 years ago, again with legislative funding. The program recruits and licenses East African teachers as students. There are 16 students today in undergraduate or graduate education programs at Augsburg campuses in Minneapolis and in Rochester. So why is state funding so important? Well, state funding really is critical to operate these programs. The funding allows us to subsidize tuition of individuals who otherwise would not be able to enroll, earn their licenses and degrees, and move on to teach in our schools. All of the four institutions have invested considerable amount of their own resources. We've received private support from foundations such as Bremer and Bush. We've also received support from individuals. Additional support in Senator D6's bill would allow us to expand the programs and to play a larger role in accelerating the diversification of the teacher workforce and to better reflect the makeup of our communities. Your packets this morning include handouts with descriptions of each of our programs. I'd be happy to answer questions later, but you're now going to hear from representatives from each of the four programs, starting with Augsburg.
Thank you, Mr. Hannes. Welcome. And we will hold on questions until the completion of the testimony.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Audrey Lenzmeyer. I'm a professor of education and the director of the EAST program at Augsburg College. Thank you, Chair Wieger, Senator Disick, and the rest of the committee for inviting me here today to speak about the success we've had in the first 2 years of our program and outline several plans for the future. As you know, more than 2 years ago, at the urging of East African leaders, Representative Jim Dabney mobilized his colleagues in the House and Senate and approached Augsburg President Paul Pribino with the idea of starting an East African teacher program. It was an honor for us to be asked to serve the needs of the East African communities. We have been, in the past 2 years, excellent stewards of state funding. To date, we have had approximately 140 inquiries and dozens of applications to our program. We have accepted 18 undergraduate and graduate students for initial licensure in our K-12 programs, elementary, secondary, including mathematics and social studies, special education, and ESL. Our scholars, as we call them, are highly accomplished already upon entry into our program. They are men and women who, some of whom have come to Minnesota as adults, and some of whom attended E-12 school here in Minnesota. We have created a diverse cohort. All are experienced working with E-12 students, all with demonstrated records of commitment to the profession of teaching. We have had only one student withdraw from our program when he went home to Kenya to care for his ailing mother. Each of our 17 scholars receives near total scholarship for tuition and fees. Research in my field of teacher education demonstrates that financial need is the biggest barrier to program completion. We have spent 77% of our allocation from the state on tuition, fees, and books. 21% on program staff, and 2% on standardized testing fees, including the MTLE. We were also invited to Washington, D.C. to speak at a national convention about our unique program. And incidentally, our program staff, Yodit Tesfaye, is an Ethiopian immigrant, so actually about 98% of the state's money goes directly back to the East African community. My work is supported by the college. We've had success with retention. Our scholars stay in the program because of financial support and our twice-monthly meetings that some of you have actually attended, where we meet for fellowship, professional development, and leadership training. Further, our scholars work hard academically and have a combined GPA over three semesters, including summer school, of 3.5. out of 4. Our program central focus and indeed our only significant outcome measure is the number of licensed teachers of East African origin working in Minnesota schools. We are on track to have 5 licensed teachers by May, 2 in ESL, 1 in special education, 1 in elementary, and 1 in secondary social studies. 4 will student teach in the fall of 2015 and 8 in the spring of 2016. We understand there to be about 20 licensed teachers of East African origin right now in the state of Minnesota. In 1 year, our program will have nearly doubled that number. These future teachers will not only have an impact on the E-12 students in our state, but their leadership and presence will have a positive impact on their white teacher colleagues and students as well. I have high hopes that these students will become our state's future leaders. What would we do with more money? There's a proposal to increase funding. With the reallocation and an increase in funding, we would continue the program as it exists now, funding 15 to 17 students at our Minneapolis campus. We would like to increase our program in 3 specific ways. One would be to offer language study on an ongoing basis. Our students come to us speaking already 2, 3, 4, 5 languages, and perhaps English is not their first language. We had a summer language institute funded by the Cargill Foundation, but a summer program isn't sufficient. With support from Augsburg College, we will expand east to serve the needs of East African communities in Rochester, in Willmar, in St. Cloud, and in Mankato, and in collaboration with my special education department colleagues, Dr. Susan O'Connor and Dr. Donna Patterson, who have already been approached by MDE to expand their successful programs outstate, including their tribal cohort. We can do this via hybrid, partially hybrid, partially residents, partially meeting face-to-face programs throughout the state. And finally, like my sister programs here in the Twin Cities, we would like to stretch our program beyond initial licensure into induction support. Those first 5 years are so critical, and it is our aim to continue to offer culturally sustaining, culturally meaningful, culturally productive support to our teachers once they're in the field. Thank you.
Thank you.
Where we are.
Welcome to the committee.
Okay. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Zamzam Moomin. It's truly an honor to speak to the legislature about the Q Fund and the impact e-scholarship has had on my pursuit to become an educator. I live, work, and go to school in Rochester, Minnesota. I received my Bachelor's of Art degree in 2010 from St. Cloud State University in International Business. In 2012, I became the director of Solar Academy, which is a daycare center. I work with children ranging from ages 6 to 12 years old. It is here where my passion to educate really flourished. Within a few months of working with this group of students, I noticed that I made a difference. They came to the daycare ready to learn, and I would always continue to challenge them all while appreciating the progress they have made. Each morning, I woke up with a sense of purpose, excitement, and enthusiasm to educate. Growing up in Rochester, I've always been the minority student in most of my classes, but I was young and unaware of its significance. As a graduate student of education at Augsburg College, pursuing a licensure in ESL, what has been of little importance in my academic setting, my race, has become the most important factor. As we study achievement gaps, I can't help but feel pressure. Here are the statistics on how racial and ethnic groups that I belong to are underachieving. What do these statistics say about me? Therefore, I often feel pressure to defy stereotypes. Currently, I'm in my 3rd semester at Augsburg College, Rochester campus. I'm once again the only minority student in most of my classes. I've been a lone ranger in tackling difficult subjects. During a classroom lecture in my 1st semester, the professor asked, "What is a determinant factor in intelligence?" Expecting to hear comments such as poverty or early educational opportunities, I heard instead one of my classmates respond with race as being the determinant factor in intelligence. I looked at my classmate in dismay, then around the classroom full of educators, thinking somebody would jump in and say, absolutely not. I also expected the professor to correct the student. However, nothing of what I expected occurred. Instead, I just saw nodding heads in agreement with what my classmate and a future educator had said. Therefore, I just sat there silently reliving my previous educational experiences. It is in these moments that I realized the importance of e-scholarship, or e-program. Not only has e-scholarship alleviated me from a financial burden, of course, there's no way that I could afford to pay $5,000 to $6,000 per semester or take out loans as interest is prohibited in my faith. But beyond the financial stability, the e-scholarship has given me strength, the strength to continuously strive to be a better student, an advocate for my future students, and to become a great educator. In return, when I become a teacher, I hope to create an environment where students have support to overcome any barriers. Therefore, I urge the legislature to continuously fund this important program, not only for the betterment of our profession, but for the betterment of the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your inspiring testimonial.
Thanks.
Welcome.
Well, good morning, and thank you very much for the honors for being here this morning. My name is Na. I'm one of the student graduates from the Southeast Asian Teacher License Program from Concordia University back in 2005. I'm currently teaching in College Prep Elementary School, K-6, in the Hmong Language Program. And I see that the Southeast Asian Teacher License Program is very important to me. It's not only myself, to my family as well. My daughter also recently graduated from the program as she is teaching in the school right now. And one of my son, he is currently in the program right now. And the program is not only planning or only teaching or helping the training the teacher students to become a teacher, but also we expanded from the program for teaching, and also we expanded to help students or young leaders out in the community to become future leaders. We also expanded the Empowering Hmong Women program to help the women how to help themselves, how to search for resources to come and help with their family. And at the same time, we expand the Hmong culture and language program within our seed program. And since 2004 up until now, we have served more than thousands of students the program and training a lot of young people to become leaders in the community. And moving on to that, I will let Mr. Lohr talk about that too.
All right, first of all, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for giving me this opportunity to talk on behalf of the C program. It's my honor to be here and to speak to all of you this morning. First of all, my name is Dow Lohr. Currently, I am a service administrator at Hmong College Prep Academy. As an alumnus of the C program, I see that the program brings a lot of benefits and a lot of positive things to the community, more so especially to the idea of equity education. I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but as you all know, education is the most, as Mandela once said, education is the most powerful tool that we can use to change the world. And especially with the issue that we face with the global, with achievement gap, not just the achievement gap in Minnesota or the United States, but in the world, is that in order for the United States and for our nation and for the state of Minnesota to be a competitive person or in this world, we need to train our teacher. We need to train our educator and especially our student to be a competent leader as well as to be a competent individual who is ready when he or she leads the school or the community to be part of that community. And this is something what the C program is currently doing. What's important to me and why top of the C program is that this program brings in qualified or overly highly qualified individual who, one, is already working in the school, and two, this individual already had the pedagogy to succeed in the classroom. What they don't have is that they just don't have the licenses that is needed to be a teacher. And as administrator, that's what I look for. And because that is pretty much what the C program brings to the student
and more so is that what's bringing to the community. But one thing that is very imperative about the C programs that it, one, it prepares students, and also it prepares people to be leader of the community. And as it's not said, that program not just only make individual a teacher or administrator, but the program prepares the people to be part and to be that, to be a citizen of the community, and to know that, you know what, I myself can impact my community as well as impact the overall success of the school. And more so, well, what is especially important to me about the C program is because that program brings the people to the program, but also bring the program to the individual who is also living, breathing in there. And so this makes it really, really important that and that I hope that the committee and continue to fund this program. It's because I have always believed in this idea, and it will continue to do that. How can you teach me if you don't know me? I'm not saying that my colleagues are not competent teachers, but I believe that in order for Minnesota to be a competitive state and for our nation to be a competitive nation, as the rest, we must educate our teacher to be to reflect the people they are serving. Thank you.
Thank you for your passion and commitment, Mr. Towell, Mr. Torrey, Ms. Towell. And again, we'll open for questions following the next two testifiers.
Thank you.
Mr. Lawrence and Ms. Lawson, I have listed. Welcome.
Morning. Morning, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dietzick, members of the committee. I'm Dan Lawrence, Emeritus Vice President of University Relations at Hamline and Associate Professor in Hamline School of Education. I'm speaking today for Dean Nancy Sorensen, who couldn't be here. She's also the acting director of the Center for Excellence in Urban Teaching. That's how important she thinks it is. So this has been an effort at Hamline, as you've heard, since 1996. We were encouraged to get into this by a grant from the St. Paul companies, who went on to fund this at more than $3 million over its early time. It's attracted more than $5 million, but its focus is an urban learner framework and a certificate in urban teaching, and it's focused on the retention of teachers in the first 3 years. So while we have a preparation program, of course, for teachers and teachers of color, we have a particular focus on this. And the effort is not just in the Twin Cities, but it is statewide. The urban learner framework lends itself very nicely to professional development that could end up in the certificate in urban teaching, but doesn't necessarily have to. So over the course of 19 years that the program's been involved, we've been in every corner of the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lawrence. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for giving me this very unique opportunity to address you this morning. It is an honor, a privilege, and a very, very unique experience for me. My name is Fatima Lawson, as you've already heard, a very proud urban educator. As an immigrant and someone not only very interested in education, but a strong proponent of public education, my story began, actually, when I completed my doctorate in education at the U of M and could not find a job anywhere in the public school system. I had visited a couple of elementary schools in the course of my preparation and had fallen in love with teaching and learning the way it is done in the American way, especially. Each time I applied, I received responses like, "You are too qualified," "You are not qualified," "The students may not understand you," or "You do not have a license," etc. I was perplexed, for as a PhD holder and in the area of education, you think that you could get a job anywhere and you will get to teach anywhere. The experience was demoralizing, discouraging, and very troubling, to say the least. I wallowed in sadness and hopelessness, knowing fully well that I had a lot to offer students with my background and experiences, until my academic advisor, bless his heart, who happened to have heard of this program called the Collaborative Urban Education Program, advised me and encouraged me also to apply. I applied with a lot of apprehension, thinking that all those excuses would surface again, but to my greatest surprise and appreciation, this program gave me the chance of a lifetime. When I received the admission letter, I knew it was something divine and was poised to give it my very, very best, make a difference in the lives of others that I have so much yearned to touch in urban education for several years, especially after graduation. I went through the rigorous 13-month program, which is a combination of theoretical, practical, and field experiences that prepared me, as well as others in my cohort, to confront the issues that have been plaguing public education. What I felt when I first walked into the classroom that was to become my own was magical. Words alone cannot express or explain that. I was in a school with predominantly minority students, could not be happier when I made the connection with all students, not just the minority students. Some responded to me because they were excited about my accent. Others, because I was not your typical teacher, and others, because they shared one or two things with me, which are common, so they could see that connection. Whatever be the case, every student within my care felt a connection that only grew stronger as the years progressed. My success as a teacher and in touching lives, coupled with strong encouragement by my superiors, gave me the impetus to get into administration. As an administrator, I worked in one of the most challenging schools in the district before moving to another setting, which was a gifted and talented school as an assistant principal, with a totally different type of challenges, of course. No matter where I was placed, my preparation as an urban educator served me well and came in very handy. My first job as a principal was to help open a new immersion school. Needless to say, I opened and led one of the most successful language immersion schools in the state, growing it from 143 students to over 650 students and moving it to two campuses. I am currently working as a teacher, as a principal on special assignment in charge of alternative education programs for the district. In this new role, I continually draw on my training as an urban educator to prepare and promote programs and opportunities for some of our most marginalized students. The Q program is the very best in terms of preparing urban educators, who in turn help to prepare all other students for success in a global community and also for success in the 21st century. More importantly, this is one unique program that gives people who would otherwise never have seen the four walls of a classroom the chance to teach and contribute to the growth and success of posterity. It is therefore my very humble ambition to see this program continue as we respond to huge disparities in educational achievement of our minority students. Thank you very much for the opportunity to address you this morning.
Well, thank you, Dr. Lawson. We salute your determination, drive, and success.
Thank you.
We'll open it up now for questions of the testifiers. Senator Bonhoff, and I believe we had a couple of other hands up, if you could remind me, and Senator Kiffmeyer, Senator Clausen, Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Zietzik, I actually have to run to have a bill up in taxes, so I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank you so much for bringing this forward and to let all those who testified know how much we believe in this approach. And I know last year the Higher Ed Committee also heard this bill, and we felt very strongly that it was important that we support it to grow. And so just wanted to affirm that commitment. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoff. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very interesting testimony. I wanted to have a question to ask of Professor Lawrence and Ms. Lawson, if I could.
Okay.
And so my question, as you're coming to the table, as I was reading your material, fascinating program and wonderful stories that is certainly that, but I came across a phrase that I thought, I just don't quite know what this means, and we don't often get to have such expert testimony that we can actually ask a question of. So I'm reading here, applying in for the Hamline University, applying proven culturally relevant pedagogical practices in urban and urban-like schools. And so my question has to do with, when you're teaching reading or math or some of these other things, How is culturally relevant pedagogical practices different in an urban and urban-like school? How is there that difference? Because when I think of teaching reading, so I can kind of guess at that, but I thought we have experts here. So I'll just ask you what that means to you.
And Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Lawrence?
I think, you know, an area of focus. It's an area of focus. You're absolutely right. I mean, there are other applications, and there should be applications in all classrooms, but we were looking particularly at research on the challenges in urban and what we call urban-like, and that's the issue in terms of it's just not urban schools, but there are schools everywhere that have similar characteristics, and there are children everywhere that have similar characteristics. So we think that this was an area not necessarily an area of expertise that came out of general preparation programs. I mean, you might think about it as a physician being prepared who gets a specialty. But what we wanted to do was to make sure that this got focused on and talked about. And so that's why that appears there.
I can understand why it's there, but I just wanted to get a little bit more of what specifically. So if you can give an example of how it's different.
Well,
Mr. Lawrence, and for the tape, each time a testifier gives another statement, just for the tape, state your name. Thank you.
Okay. So, again, you want me to do that right now?
Yeah.
Mr. Dan Lawrence, Hamline University. So, the in the report, I don't know whether you've seen our January report where we talk about urban-like variables in classroom populations. Yeah. I could read this down. This is the examples that we have. So. Do you want me to read them, Senator?
No, but I don't have a copy here. That would be helpful, so Okay. Maybe we can get
and
a link to that.
It is in the report, and I'd be happy to meet with you also to talk about it.
Wonderful.
Yes. That's noted for the record. We'll have follow-up. No, Senator Klausel is next, but I believe Senator Torres-Ray, did you have a follow-up on this question?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Senator Kiffmeyer, I hope, I don't know.
Senator Kiffmeyer yields.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I presume Dr. Lawson knows this, but culturally relevant pedagogy has been defined. And so culturally relevant pedagogy is really the ability to learn the skill to teach effectively in different in diverse cultural settings. What we know is that cultural settings in urban schools have become incredibly diverse. And it's not only the volume. I know I have an expert now because she was in the she was working with me when I just got elected on this issue. So I presume I'm going to ask you, Dr. Lansmeyer, to expand on this. But so what I know is that in order to really develop the skills to teach in cultural settings where there is significant diversity, not only in terms of the background of the students, but also the setting in which the actual teacher is teaching. So examples of that, for instance, in my district, in Senator Disick's district, where we have significant pockets of Somali population. Senator Hayden has significant schools where about 78% in one of his schools are Latino children whose language, primary language, is not English. In order to teach in that classroom, you have to have knowledge of that cultural setting and that cultural diversity that the students bring. So ideally, you need to have a teacher, for instance, in a kindergarten room where you know that more than 50% of the kids that are coming to learn specific aspects of reading and recognizing letters, you might have to start with, you know, some native language and then progress into English language. So all of those factors are culturally relevant factors that need to be adapted to classroom teaching. That's what I understand, but you have some experts now in the room that can definitely expand on that.
May I?
Yes, please.
Thank you very much, Audrey Lensmeyer, Augsburg College. Senator Torres-Ray, thank you for that. We go way back. When I finished my PhD at the University of Minnesota and published a book called White Urban Teachers, I've got a lot of experience thinking about this. Gloria Ladson Billings, professor at UW-Madison, wrote a book called Dream Keepers about the practices of culturally relevant teachers, and the most important thing is to know yourself. Research demonstrates over and over that schools are set up with white middle-class values and norms, including common sense ideas like pull yourself up by your bootstraps and our society is a meritocracy. People of color don't experience our society that way. Working class white folks don't experience our society that way. There really isn't an achievement gap. There's an opportunity gap. The achievement gap says that all students, no matter what your background, need to compare and measure up and compete against white people. I'll give you a very specific example.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
If I can just clarify.
Sure.
I don't question at all.
Yeah.
All right. So I think my question is much more simple and is being misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to, I know you have a very full agenda, Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. and a lot of other testifiers that are here, so I don't want to take up a whole lot more time. I was just looking for some examples, but I would rather just have those in my office where we
sure.
can have maybe a little more time to talk about that. I'll look at the link and do some of those things. But my question was much more simple than where we are going, and I know you have such a full agenda. So my apologies.
I'll just give two examples. One would be having multicultural children's books, having books that represent all sorts of families. That'd be a culturally relevant practice.
Mm-hmm.
The second would be, an example would be the NABAD program at Sullivan School. It's a newcomer English language program. Some of the teachers traveled to Kenya last year, took photographs, brought the photographs back to the classroom, and used those photographs, their culturally relevant photographs, to teach language. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe we addressed this portion of the inquiry enough, and we'll get some follow-up as needed. Senator Claussen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick word of support for Senate File 398. On two occasions, I've had the opportunity with Senator Desick to travel to Augsburg and meet with Dr. Lenzmeyer and other professors in the program and students, and it's always rather inspiring to leave there knowing of their experience that they're having, the enthusiasm, their commitment, and also, as was stated before, with a 4% teachers of culture in our state and a growing population of students of color, it's a program that we need to invest in. So thank you, Senator Dietzick, for bringing this bill forward. Thanks.
Thank you. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Desick, I would like to work with you to see if there is an opportunity for us to follow up on really supporting the teachers after they graduate and come into the classroom. As you know, the statistics don't look very good for us. And for us, meaning Minnesota, in terms of really the experiences that teachers have after they come into the classroom, they just really don't have the mentoring, induction, support that they need. And one thing is to learn, you know, all the skills in college and then really figure out how do you put that in practice really requires a tremendous amount of effort that we just really in Minnesota have not invested in. So I'm curious to see if you would be open to perhaps talk to the group and perhaps come back next year to figure out how do we follow up, how do we support these teachers in their journey, and then kind of developing some groups that can work together and support that effort in the future. I don't know if you have heard anything related to that, but I think that's an important issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Torres-Ray, I agree with you. Hamline does have a portion, I believe a portion of the Hamline's program is actually geared towards retention of teachers, especially in the critical first few years. But I agree that expanding that would help greatly.
Thank you, Senator Dietzick. Is there anyone in the audience that hasn't testified that would like to on Senate File 398? If not, Senator Dietzick, excuse me, I didn't see your hand. Yes, please join Senator Dietzick and others and state your name for the record. Welcome.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Sally Bass from the Southeast Asian Teacher Program. I just wanted to speak to the last comment that you made. We have had the circle of support that has been part of the Southeast Asian Teacher Program for about as many years as I've been at Concordia. And that has now used to be a program where Minneapolis and St. Paul each had some funding. And so when our students went into those two districts, we had an opportunity to meet once a month with the mentor in that district and the mentor from the university. Now I do that mentoring by e-mentoring, staying in contact with our students who have graduated, who are now teachers, who are working in schools, and I make contact with them every 1 to 2 months electronically, so there we have e-mentoring going on. So I just wanted you to know that's called a circle of support. We support our students as they come in, as they go through the program, and then as they are inducted into their position. So I just wanted you to know that that was in place.
Thank you. Senator Dames, did you have a question?
No, I just wanted you to recognize the person.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Dames, for doing that. Yeah, sometimes we, with the pillars, we're not going to see each hand that's up, so more eyes are helpful. Okay, and Senator Dietzick, we will lay the bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. And as you know, it's not included in the governor's recommendation for additional funds. The base funding's there, but the $2.8 million that would be included for what you're asking for will be given a great deal of consideration as we review the various requests as we roll out our bill. Also, Senator Bonhoff, the Higher Ed Committee, she expressed her interest, and it possibly may be reviewed by that committee as well. So, again, on behalf of the committee, we'd like to thank you, Senator Dietzick, to each of the testifiers, and Senate File 398 will be laid over.
Thank you.
Next, Senate File 558, Senator Wicklund. We'll wait about 1 minute for those of you that are back, headed back to school.
Church, how's he doing?
Doing great, yeah. Yeah?
I have a lot of material to do with you. I'm interested. Yeah, because this question comes a lot.
Senator Wicklund, as we await the transition, you were invited to ask your witnesses to join you.
Somali kids.
Say hi to Ian Donald for me.
Yeah, for sure. I just saw him last
night. It was the Guardians.
Which? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
An example.
Absolutely. Thanks for the invite and the support.
Yeah.
I'm
surprised that they didn't.
Curious.
Okay, and if the door could be closed, please, then.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah. That's
excellent. Now, before us is Senate File 558, Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. I do have Senate File Number 558. This is a bill to increase school board flexibility for allocating compensatory revenue. The bill, as it states, is simply increasing flexibility. It doesn't change funding amounts. Compensatory revenue comes to schools based on a formula that has to do with the concentration of high-risk, low-income, and minority students. It would simply change the allocation to allow up to 50% of the money to go to specific school sites for the uses of compensatory funds based on a school board developed plan. This would be a change from the current 5% allocation. And this would simply would allow local districts to have more authority to look at their district in a holistic way and determine how to best allocate the money to support the students that the compensatory funding is directed towards. And I have three testifiers here today. From two of them are from districts I represent, from Bloomington and Richfield, and then also Superintendent Behrens from Rosemont Apple Valley. So,
okay. Thank you, Senator Wicklund, and we'll proceed with the testimony.
Go ahead.
Start. Thank you. Sure. Thank you, Chair Wieger. My name is Chris Lennox. I'm the Assistant Superintendent in the Bloomington Public Schools. I am here to testify in support of these changes to Senate File 558. One of the things I would ask this group to consider is the legislation recently passed on World's Best Workforce. This is an opportunity, this change, for us to really make sure that we're making achievements for all students. This is an opportunity, as the legislature is expecting all schools to make sure every student is kindergarten ready, reading at third grade, graduating, college and career ready, and to close all identifiable achievement gaps. You can't do that site by site. Districts must look at that comprehensively. We have to look at our plans and determine how we will do that for every one of the children we educate. To do that, this bill then would provide us with more flexibility as we put our plans together. It would require us to work closely with students, parents, staff at each of our sites to assure that we're making the adjustments and the changes we need so that we close the gaps and educate our children. This, I think, increases school districts' availability to be able to meet the expectations that our public has and that the legislature has relative to the world's best workforce. I know in Bloomington we've completely refreshed our strategic plan. Our school board is committed to moving in a systemic direction. I am also confident about our ability to achieve those goals. I know you've had testimony from Bloomington staff on early childhood and the work they're doing there. Recently, the commissioner was out at one of our elementary schools talking about PBIS and other things that we're doing within the state and in Bloomington to make sure our students are achieving. And next fall, Bloomington will be open our College and Career Academy. So at all ends, from earliest learners to adults, we're seeing achievement increase, and we're looking for more flexibility to make sure that we're meeting their needs. This bill, these changes, would help us do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Senator Wieger, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Steve Yanowski. I'm the superintendent of Richfield Public Schools. Our goal in Richfield is to relentlessly pursue high achievement for all of our students. Richfield is a very diverse district. We have almost 70% students of color. We have 66% poverty, and almost 35% of our students are English language learners. Point of pride of our school district this year is our graduation rate, where our high school surpassed the state graduation rate for the first time in many years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Our efforts to gain high achievement for all of our students are hampered by a lack of local control with regard to our compensatory education. And to give you an example, I'd like to talk a little bit about two of our elementary schools, Richfield Dual Language School and Centennial Elementary. Our Richfield Dual Language School is a statewide focus school, meaning that the achievement gap and the achievement are amongst the 10% of lowest across the state of Minnesota. Centennial results are different. RDLS is 9 points behind our Centennial school in mathematics achievement and is 3% behind in reading. RDLS is 60% poverty. Centennial is 87% poverty. So what does this mean? On a very local level, at RDLS, our school that is a focus school, our school that has lower achievement than Centennial or higher poverty, we have less social work for our children. We have less intervention supports for our children. We have larger class sizes for our children. These are not decisions that I would make as a superintendent. These are not the decisions that our school board would make. However, due to the complexity of compensatory education funding, these are the decisions that we must make. Building on some of the conversation and questions from an earlier bill, some of the things that I might do, and building on the comments of Senator Torres Ray, without the funding flexibility, we are not able to implement some of those culturally relevant teaching practices. Some of the things like buying books in Spanish for a dual language class that we are unable to do because of that. And that is one of the best practices in ELL dual language instruction. being able to have books that represent our children. So our Latino children, of which we are 50% at RDLS, are not able to read about Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, where if we wanted to utilize those funds, we've been able to have those books at Centennial Elementary. And again, decisions we would not make. We would like all of our children to have full opportunity to all of our funds in a way that would support achievement across all of our schools. Finally, I just want to urge you to consider Bill 558, sponsored by Senator Wicklund, to allow us the opportunity at our local level to ensure achievement for all of our children. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Welcome.
Thank you. Sorry. We're getting a little close here. Thanks so much for inviting me, too, to be here. Chair Wieger and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today about Senate File 558. My name is Jane Behrens, and I am superintendent of the Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan School District. It's a big school district. We're the fourth largest district in the state, and we serve more than 27,400 children, 9 communities, and it's 110 square miles. And I, too, as I said, am in support of this important bill. You know, I had a lot to say, so lucky for you, I'm going to condense it a bit right now because so much of what you both have said, but it's all about systemic change. And as we move forward for all of our children in District 196, we know the importance of programming that will help all children. So to give you an example, a very small example, we have 18 elementary schools. Our school that has the most compensatory aid, it has received $638,000. And our other school, the last school that receives the least amount of compensatory aid, receives $11,000. So as we were talking about how we could do preschool targeted for all of our schools, the school with the $638,000 can have preschool for their attendance area. The school that has $11,000 for compensatory aid, who do have kids who are in need, cannot afford preschool. So when you think about 196 and we think about the achievement gap, which we have as, like everybody else, we would really appreciate the ability to look at it from a systems point of view. And we would like all kids to have the opportunity to have preschool who need it. And without compensatory aid that I could help those other schools, Shannon Park Elementary could not. That's the school that has the least amount of kids in poverty. And so the school that had the most compensatory aid, the principal actually turned to me and said, could I give them some of my compensatory aid? And so I went, oh, note to self. This would really be a good idea because all children in all of our schools could use the help. So I am here in favor of the Senate File 558. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent.
Yeah.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 558? In support, or if they'd like to register that, or any concern? Not questions from the committee. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my understanding, if I'm correct, basically would let schools bump up the amount of the compensatory revenue that they can set aside and use without all those strings attached and give them a lot more flexibility in how and where they use that. Is that essentially the effect of this bill?
Correct. Chair Wieger, Senator Nino, correct. I mean, today that the school districts can do that with 5% of the compensatory formula revenue. They can make plans and they can use it up for, you know, for purposes outside of the site-based. This would just give them a greater amount. It would be 50%.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Wicklund, it sounds like a good bill. I support it. There's also a proposal I announced a couple of days ago. It's introduced today, Senate File 1173. You might want to take a look at it.
So noted. Senator
Very good. We could have testimonial on the importance of compensatory as a program as well. But, no, we'll have a lot of time for the discussion. And we did see the introduction and the shout out. Okay, Senator Senator Pratt, a co-author of the bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to speak in support of the bill. I think many of us that have served on school boards agree that the best decisions are made closest to the classroom, and so I appreciate our school folks coming and supporting it. Thank you.
Thank you. To the testifiers, Senator Wicklund. Senator Claussen, did you have a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, just one comment. You know, we had a
just a very intelligent presentation by Superintendent Behrens, and I think she probably got that from being a student in my social science.
No doubt.
Well done. I'm sure she occurs.
Reach over and pat him on the back.
Get some apples.
Yeah, yeah. Jane Behrens speaking, but yes, actually he was a great teacher. But what? I was a pretty good student, though, wouldn't you say?
Superintendent, what was the course?
It was social studies. I think it was my senior year.
Yep.
Right.
Oh, excellent. Thanks for sharing that. Senator Wicklund, thank you to the testifiers. And Senate File 558 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Chair and Committee.
Thank you. And next, Senate File 564, school lunch. And if testifiers Keefe and Bender could please join Senator Hoffman. Then we'll go to the formula presentations. Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 564. This is a real simple proposal. It increases the lunch aid from 12.5 cents per lunch to 16 cents per lunch. And with me today is Elaine Keefe. She's presenting the Minnesota School Nutrition Association, and then Jane Bender, Director of Nutrition at Minnetonka Public Schools. And welcome back from 2 years ago. So, Mr. Chair, I turn it over.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. And a fiscal note's being distributed as we proceed.
And I've prepared some examples. I know that time is always of the essence, so hopefully a picture will say 1,000 words. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jane Bender. I'm with Minnetonka Public Schools. I would like to just show you in picture format the cost of our rising food. You can see we've had new rules and regulations instituted by the USDA, and it does add to the cost of our meals, particularly more leafy greens, more fruits and vegetables. There's also more whole grains, and so hopefully the pictures will call those out to you. Adding the nutritional value it adds to, as well as the quality that the changes that this makes, it does also, there is a cost factor. Also, students are required, when they go through the line to purchase a lunch, they are required to take a half cup of a fruit or vegetable with each meal. And this is whether they plan to eat it or not. This is sometimes an additional cost when they take it and do not plan to eat it. We do try to give a lot of variety to entice them to take something that they will eat, but if they do get at the end of the line after they've chosen a meal and they don't have a fruit or vegetable, we have our package of raisins, maybe a package of carrots, or maybe even a piece of whole fruit, and encourage them just to take it so that they could perhaps consume it later. But that really isn't the intent of the school lunch program. The intent of the program, of course, is for lunch, not for snacks later. I also wanted to point out that along with the school regulations, a lot of Minnesota programs work to support their local farms and communities by buying, purchasing directly from farmers or working with their produce wholesalers to work directly with farmers in their communities. And so we have a few examples of that on the next page. By doing this, we hope to also keep our money in our communities and support our local economy. On the last couple of pages, the 3 and 4, just to kind of show you that the kids do love their veggies. We found that when we make the salads, instead of put a salad bar in front of them, that we can end up making an awful lot of salads. They will take them. Again, the fresh produce is another added cost, but it's a very healthy choice for them to consume for the lunchtime. And the picture that you see there is a lunch for an elementary child, and that will be served with complimentary whole grain rolls and milk and other fruit choices as well. Let's see. And I just wanted to point out that the 3.5 cents that we are asking for, it really does make a difference. When schools raise lunch prices, they often raise it only by a nickel or by 10 cents, and often that will affect the participation of the children. When people drop out of the participation of the school lunch program due to economies, it's usually those people that are right on the border of being able to have a free or reduced lunch. So that this can really help the people that are right on the border being accepted into those benefits. Let's see. I guess I wanted to mention, too, that when Congress, the USDA, first started about making these nutritional changes and helping to increase the quality of our programs, anywhere from 35 cents to a dollar per meal was discussed that we would need to make these changes. And quite frankly, the 6 cents that they decided on to give us to implement all of the changes from the USDA is not really cutting it for most of the districts. Almost all of the school nutrition programs in Minnesota are self-sustaining entities within their own district, so that if we do not cover our costs ourselves, then that will have to be covered by the general fund. And nobody wants to take money out of the general fund for the school nutrition program. The new regulations have also affected our a la carte sales, and many school districts have made note that the a la carte sales are down this year. And when I say a la carte sales, I'm talking about extra water, maybe extra juice, extra fruit, things like that. Another factor is that when we raise our lunch prices to cover all of these wonderful changes that I believe in, it comes to a point where the parents actually can send a lunch to school cheaper. Used to be school lunch was just the greatest value, and my gosh, I couldn't pack a lunch for my child when they were going to school when I could pay for less for the school lunch. So these days, with all of these changes, yes, you can send a home lunch to school, but it is not going to have the quality, it's not going to have the produce, it's not going to have the whole grains, it's not going to have the same nutritional value. But for parents who are really struggling in this economy, it makes a difference for their balancing their budgets at home. And I did want to say, too, on the last page, kind of just to show you some typical salad bars that we have at our middle and high schools. The very bottom picture shows you the several multiple fruit and veggie choices we try to put out at all the grade levels just to encourage them to fulfill their one-half cup fruit and vegetable. But you can see that these aren't the same hot lunch school lunches that you grew up with. These are some really wonderful meals. They've got no trans fats. We're looking at our sodium levels. We're whole grain rich. So there's a lot of the school meals. They've not only improved nutritionally, but the quality of it, and is just wonderful for the kids. And yes, we do have to work a little bit on the acceptability of it, but we are really providing a wonderful service for our communities by making these changes. I guess I just hope that we could allow for a 3.5 cent increase, because I think it's important in the future that we keep the nutritional integrity of this program together, that we maintain the variety of fresh fruits and vegetables and whole grains that we can give for the children. And I would really love to lose that stigma that school lunch is just junk food.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bender, and excellent handout. I'm sure everybody's hungry. Ms. Keefe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Elaine Keefe, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Nutrition Association, and I just want to add a few points. School lunch reimbursement has increased by just 0.5 cent over the last 8 years, and so that's about a 4% increase. By contrast, over the most recent 8-year period for which we have figures, the cost of producing a school lunch has gone up by almost 25%. So this increase is really very badly needed. School nutrition programs are increasingly reliant on state and federal reimbursements because the proportion of lunches served either free or reduced keeps growing. And I'll give you an example. In the 2003-04 school year, statewide, 35% of lunches were served free or reduced, and 65% were fully paid. By the 2012-13 school year, and that's the most recent year for which we have figures, 47% of the lunches were served free or reduced, and 53% were paid. And I'm guessing there's usually a 2-year lag in the data. By the time we get the data for this year, I'm guessing that we will see over 50% served free or reduced. And so this trend means that the state aid is more and more vital to schools to help them cover the cost of a school lunch. This bill has been endorsed by the bipartisan Childhood Obesity Legislative Working Group, by the Minnesota's for Healthy Kids Coalition, and also Partners Stand Hunger. So we would very much appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Keefe. I'll ask Mr. Wilms to just highlight the fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. As you know, this bill increases the reimbursement rates for paid and free and reduced lunch by 3.5 cents. Within your packet, you have the fiscal note as well as the national table on school reimbursement rates. The annual cost of the program or of this increase would be about $3.5 million for a $7 million biannual increase. This proposal will bring the total cost of the school lunch program to approximately $19.5 million and rising slightly each year after. I should also note that while the governor's proposal did include a free breakfast proposal, this proposal was not included for some additional context there.
On that.
Yes, Sarah Bonham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Wilms. Can you remind us what the governor's free breakfast proposal cost?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, the approximate cost was $28 million each year.
Thank you.
And it was free breakfast for grades up to three.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer, we'll open up to the committee and then also ask if anyone else would like to testify before we lay it over. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things, and again, very appetizing, I've met with my school lunch folks and really impressed with what is going on there. And I know that appetites do change, so when you start offering these things. But I've also heard, though, the mandated must take something and some of the waste sometimes that goes with it. You really feel bad that when you offer, but if it's on the plate, that doesn't mean it is necessarily eaten. And I think being patient with that as they learn to adapt is just fine. But I am concerned also. Could you maybe just address that overall from what you observe, how its impact is on your cost?
Yep. Ms. Bender.
Jane Bender from Minnetonka School District. Yes, we did initially see a little bit of waste. A lot of our students have always enjoyed a lot of the fresh things that we brought in from the farming communities. And so we decided the way to go was to really increase our fresh produce because that tended to be something that they would really go for. This week we do have fresh strawberries. And so, you know, so little treats and things, if you can kind of make it appealing to them. I think it's just a little bit of a learning curve. The children are learning that it's healthier for them to choose the fruit, and as opposed to maybe filling up on a main entree, they're learning. We're learning that we need to give a lot of choices. We can't just put out one or two items, a banana and a pear. We need to try and really spread out the different fruits and vegetables that we showcase for them so that there's at least a half a cup. In Minnetonka, for example, we often have three different varieties of fruits and three different vegetables, and we're really pulling for them to get that half cup out of that choice. And so what we did to help kind of cut down on that waste was at the very end of the line, if they still had their tray, they didn't have a half a cup on there, we would ask them, would you like to take, we have fruit baskets, would you like to take a piece of fruit? Don't forget. And then it would maybe be an orange, banana, and apple, something that they could take with them out of the cafeteria, or perhaps a small bag of carrots or a small box of raisins.
Yeah.
So,
good to hear. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to address Senate File 564? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think one of the other comments that I heard from many of the schools in my district is that for our young people who are very athletically active in the day and what have you, that quite frankly, the school lunch just was not cutting it in terms of their needs. And in fact, a number of them just quit eating school lunch and brought their own because of that factor. Can you share any insight into that?
I think part of that arose just, I'm sorry, Jane Bender from Minnetonka. I think part of that arose from media. The USDA program never really was intended to support the athletics appetite. It was to give the average student the average calories they need to get them from lunch through the rest of the school day. But many athletes previously and currently do, they will purchase, and that would be what I refer to as the a la carte piece. They might purchase a second entree or a second full lunch. I just know when I was in high school, that was very common with the athletes back then, that they would purchase two tickets and get two full lunches. So that I think that has come maybe more to the attention of the media recently, but I don't know that that's really a new problem. I think that athletes always have had larger appetites. Maybe some school districts give out larger servings, but technically we were always supposed to be giving out proper servings and portion sizes for a typical lunch and the typical student's caloric and nutritional needs.
Hello, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to say I have been a guest in the Minnetonka School cafeteria, and the food is really excellent, and so thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a question, a kind of follow-up on what Senator Weber was talking about. So if a student-athlete wants to purchase a second lunch, he has the opportunity to do that. How about a student that's on free or reduced lunch? What do they do if they're an athlete?
The USDA, I'm sorry.
For the team.
Jane Bender, Mr. Chair. The USDA will not pay for a full second lunch, so that would be considered an a la carte purchase, and then the child on the free and reduced program would have to pay for that second lunch or entree or extras that they would use to supplement. That's just been kind of the way it's been. I'm not saying it's right, but it would be up to the children to pay for any extras that they add to the free meal.
Thank you. It appears that puts them at a severe disadvantage, but thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for the comments. Members, is there anyone else with questions, comments at the table or in the audience? If not, Senate File 564 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And finally, we have formula bills, Senators Hoffman and Clausen. And we also have fiscal note and some other material, I believe, that is in the packet. We have several testifiers, and they're each year, I believe, in support of increase on formula, inflation, et cetera. And I'll ask the authors to coordinate the testimony as you would like. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There are 15 listed testifiers, so I'm going to be real quick on my opening remarks, and I know as well as Senator Clausen, so we can get to those. But I just want to remind folks, 2 years ago when we became a new Senate, we sat in this very room, and there was a certain man named Eric Nauman who held up the Minnesota Constitution about Article 13, if you guys recall that. I just want to make emphasis on that. We need to establish a general and uniform system of public schools, and that is something that is our charge. And we're here today to talk about, in my bill, it's about raising the per pupil unit $300, Mr. Chair and members. We know the districts that are around us. I know Katie McGuire is here from Osseo School District. They have always said, and I and in my years as a school board member as well, on the Hennepin School District, is we need 2%. Period, to even just do what we were doing from the year before. But if you're looking at the salaries and the increase in insurance, we need to start moving those percentages up in the per pupil unit. Plus, it actually gets us back to equalizing our fair share in what we need to do for students in the state of Minnesota, and reminds us of the Minnesota Constitution that Eric Nauman held up for us 2 years ago. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Senator Clausen.
And Senator Hoffman, you have an author's amendment in A1, and I'll entertain your motion to move the author's amendment, A1. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Adopted A1 on Senate File 163, and yeah, it's a one-liner. You'll see that. Senator Clausen.
Well, good morning, Chairman Wieger and committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to introduce Senate File 541. Which is a proposal to increase the general education formula for the state. There are actually two main provisions. The first provides for a basic revenue increase of 4% for 2016 and 4% again for 2017. The second provision provides for fiscal 2018 and beyond that the basic revenue allocation is increased 1% plus the percentage change in the consumer price index. As Senator Hoffman has pointed out, the Minnesota Constitution specifically states the obligation of the state to fund K-12 education. But it also has an obligation to fund public schools adequately and equitably. Only adequate and predictable funding for public education can there be equitable educational opportunities for every student in our state. State pupil funding in Minnesota was significantly above the national average in the mid-1990s before beginning a long-term decline. In fact, there are many years in the 1990s Minnesota was in the top five of all states for per pupil spending. In 2008 marked a turning point for Minnesota. For the first time in history, Minnesota fell at or below the national average in per pupil spending. And this trend has continued, with studies showing Minnesota currently the 24th state in K-12 educational investment, as reported by federal government statistics. As the state's financial support for the K-12 public school system has declined, districts have turned to voter-approved property tax levy referendums for operating revenue. Senate File 541 attempts to shift public education funding back to the states and away from local levies. Local levies should not be used as a replacement for state-appropriated operating per-pupil funding. Commissioner Casilius, in her presentation last week to this committee, indicated there are Minnesota school districts with reserve funds of 20% to 30%. This is due to unpredictable state funding, leaving several property wealth-poor districts or districts having difficulty passing levy referendums no choice but to build up reserve funds to avoid statutory operating debt. These reserve funds would be more appropriately allocated to the classroom if adequate state funding were available. You have two handouts that I'd like to turn your attention to. One identifies a number of states with inflation-adjusted educational formulas. The second you have is a comparison financial run for districts that would include the provisions in Senate File 541. So you can see individual changes in the funding to each district in the state based upon 541. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senators Claussen and Hoffman. And we'll proceed with testimony. Ms. Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Denise Dietrich, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association, where we represent over 2,000 school board members across the state. First of all, I would like to say on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association, I want to thank the authors and the co-authors of Senate File 163 for taking what one might call the less glamorous approach to education funding, but nonetheless a leadership role in supporting one of the most important investments that we are going to make this legislative session. This is the number one legislative priority for our school board members this session. $300 on the basic formula each year may seem like a lot of money. Well, it is, and rightfully so. But we must mention, in the previous 13 years of education funding in our state on the formula, that 11 of those 13 years have been under inflation. 5 of those years, there was no increases to the formula. Now is the time to make up for some of those years where we could not live up to our constitutional obligation of adequately funding public education. The basic education formula is the core. It's the mission. It's the bread and butter in our school district finances. It cannot be ignored, nor should it be, and nor should it be underfunded. Now is the time to reinvest, since we do have a surplus. Funding the basic formula is fair, and it treats all students equally valuable. It demonstrates the respect for teaching, the teaching profession, which we all agree we need to do, be in the business of attracting more qualified people to. It authentically respects the commitment of our school board members and local control. It also acknowledges the changing demographics of our student population in Minnesota. Senator Hoffman's bill of $300 on the formula each year of the biennium would provide the revenue to maintain the current level of programming in our school districts. It would allow us to maintain class sizes and hopefully, in some cases, if you look at class sizes around the states in middle school and high schools, it would allow us to reduce some of our class sizes. It would allow us to retain our high-quality teachers and support staff. And finally, and probably the most important, which was spoken about earlier today, it would allow for new strategies to emerge in our local schools to close the achievement gap, get more kids ready for kindergarten, and have all students reading well by third grade. And it would also help us make sure that all students are graduating from high school. And in addition to those yearly ongoing costs and strategies, we have a couple of new state directives that I would just like to point out. One of those is that we are no longer asking that all of our students just be prepared for college. We are asking our schools to make sure that all students are career ready and college ready. Another statewide strategy is we have just developed a teacher development and evaluation system in our state. Now, these are all the right priorities for our state, for our schools, and for our students, but they do require long-term, consistent investment to encourage the predictability and stability in our school system. Given the new directions, the mandates, and demands, now is the time to make up for the previous years of underfunding and provide the adequate resources and tools that will allow our locally elected school board members to really roll up their sleeves, evaluate the strengths and weaknesses in their own districts, set new long-term goals, and develop strategic plans which will increase the academic achievement across the state. It is a time when states and the nation are trying to produce workers with skills that master new technologies, adapt to the complexities of a global economy. Now is not the time to underfund our current obligations. Today we will hear testimony from superintendents, business managers, parents, school board members, and they will provide more detail as to what is already going on in our school districts and what type of direction do we need to be going. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I conclude my comments.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kate McGuire, and I'm the superintendent for Osseo Area Schools. Thank you for providing the opportunity for me to advocate for an increase in the basic formula today. You have two documents related to my testimony, graduation rate data and another document showing some suspension data. Like all good teachers, I always start with the end in mind. I'll share evidence of results on two important metrics so that you can see the dividends from your investment. I'll tell you about practices which have led to those results. Lastly, I'll urge you to consider how your decisions this session regarding the formula allowance will impact the practitioners in Osseo area schools and our work to ensure equitable student achievement. In order to consider the data I've provided, it's important that you know who we are. Osseo Area Schools is the fifth largest district in the state of Minnesota, serving approximately 20,000 students in the northwest suburbs of Brooklyn Park, Maple Grove, Dayton, Corcoran, Rogers, Plymouth, Osseo, and Brooklyn Center. 52% of our 20,000 students are students of color. We serve the third highest number of students of color in the state of Minnesota. We serve the second highest number of Asian Pacific Islander students in the state. We have 11 racially identifiable schools, and we are a racially isolated school district. 34% of our students come from low-income families. I'd like to share examples of results on two important metrics. First, you have an infographic that shows the dramatic gains in our graduation rates, a key metric in the world's best workforce expectations. As a district, the on-time graduation rate for every racial and ethnic group and subgroup improved, with two of the groups, American Indian students and English learners, increasing by more than 25 percentage points from 2010 to 2014. You can see individual schools in our school district also saw significant increases in their respective five-year trend. I'll highlight just one. Park Center, our most racially diverse high school. Their five-year trend showed outstanding gains again, with improvements in every group measured. On-time graduation rates for English learners increased by more than 30 percentage points over the five-year period. Black and Hispanic students and those receiving free and reduced lunch made gains of more than 20 percentage points each. The second data point that I prepared for you tells the story of our efforts to reduce suspensions from school. We are aggressively tackling predictable racial disparities in our suspensions. We believe that reducing suspensions has contributed directly to the increase in graduation rates. Here's the point. Improvements like this are a result of a collective set of practices implemented over time. Here's what it takes in Osseo area schools to get the kinds of results that I've shown you and the kinds of results that you expect. It takes committed staff with a shared vision for all of our students with an eye toward racial equity. It takes teachers in classrooms with class sizes conducive to building the critical relationships that motivate students to learn. It takes effective instructional and administrative practice. It takes professional development to influence change in teaching and administrative practice. It takes an understanding of the impact of race and culture on learning. It takes a cadre of teacher coaches, staff development teachers, and racial equity staff working alongside principals and teachers in the classroom to improve their practice. In Osseo, we strategically use our resources, including QComp dollars and Academic and Integration for Minnesota revenue, to sustain 45 master teacher coaches, equity staff, including bilingual program assistants, and staff development specialists to do this work. Further, in order to keep students in school when they might otherwise be suspended from school, we need behavior intervention teachers, counselors, mental health professionals, administrators, and others who support our most behaviorally challenged students and to keep them in school. I want to thank you for making education a top priority, and I urge you to consider these bills to resource the vision that you've established through the World's Best Workforce legislation, because you have evidence that your investment is paying dividends. I urge you to provide sustainable and predictable funding for our schools through an increase in the basic formula. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much.
Thank you, Superintendent, for the very helpful handouts. Welcome, Superintendent.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Deb Henton. I'm in my eighth year as superintendent at North Branch Area Public Schools. I also have a handout for the committee, a very bright graphic. I also represent the Minnesota Association of School Administrators as the chair of the Legislative Committee for the state of Minnesota. And finally, I'm the general membership secretary of C, Schools for Equity and Education. And I want to just begin by saying Senator Claussen's remarks kind of crystallize what we are here about today and what the mission of C is, equitable education for all students. I will begin by telling you about North Branch's experience. Some of you have heard of us because we have had decades of cuts and we have inequitable funding from the state. Over $16 million in budget adjustments were made since 2003. We cut teachers and programs annually, and we moved to a four-day week. We froze contracts, and yet during that time, we had excellent staff who, despite all of the difficulties with funding, made changes and brought in programs like Project Lead the Way, devices for students, all-day, every-day kindergarten before it was funded from the state. And our elementary school that has over 1,000 kids in it, grades K through 4, if you can imagine, made reward status the last 2 years. We're very proud of what we did on very limited money. School board levy authorization has helped us overcome the decade-long hurdle that we have faced. Cuts to staff and programs have mitigated over the last 2 years. It has allowed our school district to finally be able to compete, though we're still hampered by being one of the lowest funded districts in the state of Minnesota. We've been able to return some activities for kids, some clubs, and we've added a few more programs like JROTC and ProStart, which is a culinary program. And finally, we've returned to a five-day school week this year. Like most districts, we are facing declining enrollment. But declines in enrollment should not mean an erosion of opportunities for students. Strong schools are needed for communities to thrive and grow. Taxpayers in Chisago County carry a heavy burden. They are a property-poor school district, yet they have a right to expect fair and predictable funding for their school district, a formula that's tied to the increase in inflation. Legislation will make a big difference for North Branch Area Public Schools. It will help us to keep pace funding with inflation, and it will ensure that we do not have to again enter a cycle of budget cuts. As superintendent, that's my deepest worry. I was fortunate in making a promise to the community when we went to the four-day week that if legislation came along that increased funding, we'd go back. I can say with great pride I kept that promise. Now I worry I'm going to go back into a cycle of budget cuts because we have declining enrollment and we don't have funding that's tied to inflation. We are team players at North Branch Area Public Schools. We enthusiastically embrace the world's best workforce, the anti-bullying legislation, principal and teacher evaluations, and Read Well by third grade. We also have many interventions for high school students. And now I'll get to the part that relates to the graphic that I gave you. Over a decade ago, North Branch Area Public Schools started a long drive from its own one-yard line. Time after time, we overcame adversity and made first downs. With the state's help, we are now in the red zone. To not have access to this funding is akin to having the ball taken away from us. I implore you to approve this funding and keep the ball in the game. North Branch Area Public Schools will proudly take it the rest of the way and score touchdowns for our kids, our families, our community, and our state. Thank you so much for this opportunity to testify before you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Kirby Ekstrom. I am the school board chair at the North Branch Area Public Schools. I have served on the school board for the past 15 years. When I came to the school board, North Branch Area Public Schools was known for its innovative and academic excellence. We continue to strive for educational excellence even as we struggle to survive financially. For over a decade, North Branch Area Public Schools have cut valuable staff and programs in the absence of meaningful reform to the school funding at the state level. In all, budgets were adjusted over $16 million in that time period. Sacrifice is the most common accurate word for how the lack of equitable state funding formula affected virtually all aspects of our school district. Students sacrificed a five-day school week. Staff sacrificed pay raises and instead agreed to hard pay freezes in the school district's time of need. Families sacrificed access to wonderful teachers, programs designed to help kids succeed, and reasonable class size. Last year, the state provided districts like ours a glimpse at a different way when it authorized school boards the ability to increase levies to produce more through local funding, but more is needed. Over the last 2 years or so, the state has mandated a host of new requirements, such as the world's best workforce, anti-bullying policy, principal and teacher evaluations, Read Well by grade 3, and interventions for high school students in danger of failing to graduate. North Branch Area Public Schools began offering all-day, everyday kindergarten a full year ahead of receiving funding from the state for that purpose. When the governor and the Department of Education made its position clear on 4 day a week, we changed back to 5. Even though it cost the school district $250,000 or so to do that. Our largest school, our elementary, has been named a reward school the past 2 years in a row while on a four-day schedule. Like many school districts, North Branch Area Public Schools continues to experience enrollment declines, and even with the modest increase the state allowed school boards to raise through local taxes, North Branch Area Public Schools remain one of the lowest-funded school districts in the state. Open enrollment means families can easily move to more equitable funded school districts, greener pastures, so to speak, creating problems on top of problems for our public school. High property taxes are a fact of life for residents of Chisago County and the North Branch Area Public Schools. Our portion of the county does not have a solid foundation of commercial or industrial taxpayers that other districts take for granted. Our stakeholders feel the burden of these taxes year after year. They shouldn't also have to accept less than the vast majority of Minnesotans when it comes to the education of their children. The proposed legislation would provide necessary funds for North Branch Area Public Schools to continue providing excellent educational opportunities and transforming the educational experience to a 21st century model that will create the workforce sought by the state. Without these funds and with the declining enrollment, North Branch area's public schools will soon find itself back in a pattern of cuts that took a decade to overcome. Our longstanding tradition of innovative and academic excellence hang in the balance. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Ekstrom, and for your service on the board. Mr. Pryan.
Thank you, Board Chair Wieger, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to talk today. My name is Dan Pyan. I'm the chair of the MASBO Legislative Committee. MASBO is the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. I also work as the director of finance for South Washington County Schools. And I'll talk about the formula, you know, from a statewide perspective for MASBO and a little bit about our district, although we seem to be on Channel 5 about every other day now, so you probably know all about us. When I went from private accounting to school finance, you know, in the private sector, revenue was driven by sales. And everything was based on sales, sales, sales. And I got into school finance, and I came upon this formula, and I thought, well, this is great. It seems logical. This must reflect the cost of educating a student in the Minnesota schools system. And it seemed to be for the first couple of weeks, and I realized that, it wasn't logical, and where the number came from, I'm sure it came from somewhere a long, long time ago. And then it gets stagnated, and there's years when there's no money put on it, and it's not reflective of the true cost of education. So now it's fallen over $600 behind inflation. Districts have to rely on local operating levies to just do their normal business. And this also allows districts with higher property wealth to have a financial advantage over those that don't. To be progressive and to close the achievement gaps, our district has tried many things, as these other districts have. We have everyday preschool. That costs us about $3,000 to $4,000 per student of the ones that can't afford to pay the fees. Special education, it's a statewide issue. The subsidy, cross-subsidy, in our district, that's about $525 per student that has to come out of the formula to pay the excess cost of special education. We offer elementary band and orchestra. It's still there. We were going to cut it just because we had to. That's about $400 per child that comes out of the formula. Reading recovery, wonderful program, one-to-one. That's about $1,500 per student that costs. And then foreign language in elementary schools, that's about $80 a kid. Those are things that should be on everybody's docket. And they seem to be extras because the state aid doesn't just keep up. It doesn't come up. Doesn't keep up. In our district, we're making large cuts, $8 million. We had to reduce it down with public demand. We'll have to dig into our fund balance a little further. So as it stands now, 49 people are losing their jobs in the next couple weeks, or be told they'll be losing their jobs in the next couple weeks. And if we don't pass a larger operating levy, it'll be another 20 teachers and 90 bus drivers. These bills will actually restore most all those jobs. These bills are very progressive. They'll place much less burden on the local taxpayer, and they'll go a long ways to close that inflation gap that's grown over the past 10 years. And finally, as far as MASBO is concerned, it's the biggest item on our platform to get the inflation tied to get the formula tied to inflation, and we fully support that. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pryan. Mr. Law.
Good morning, Chair, Senators. We've heard some great testimony this morning from my colleagues around the state about the impact of education and the cost of education. I'm going to tell you a different story, and I'm going to make it personal for you. If any of you have been to the dentist or the doctor or drove a car down here or live in a house that needs construction repair, or have children in our schools that need transportation, we're at crisis. In the last 2 weeks, I've attended meetings where our state is at crisis stage for mental health work. Outstate and around the metro, there's a shortage in all areas of dental careers and medical careers employees. We have in our district buildings that are 9 months behind in construction work because there's a shortage of electrical workers and tradespeople. I just heard in the Anoka County area, we're short 100 auto mechanics. We need to fill those gaps. Now, in Anoka Hennepin, you've probably heard frequently from my colleague Steve Kerr, who's here today, who appears to be down here about every other day, talking about school readiness. We meet about 90% of our students' needs through early childhood programming to get ready for school. Through CompEd funding that you've been generous with and flexible with, we are trending positively on math and reading proficiency and closing the gap in all areas. Our science proficiency for all students is in the 90th percentile in the state at the elementary level. In our middle schools, we offer comprehensive programs to keep kids engaged and more than just reading and math, and music and world language and technology education and the arts. And then by the time our kids get to high school, we offer a comprehensive college readiness programming and state exemplary career and tech ed programming. We have engineering high schools at Blaine High School. We have a biomedical high school at Coon Rapids High School. We have our STEP technical program that was certified nationally for auto repair and mechanics. We're meeting the needs in our community efficiently. The average district size in the state is about 1,000 students. We have multiple elementary schools at that size. We have some of the lowest administrative costs in the state. We have great results. It costs us about 2.5% per year to maintain that programming. We're coming off a $3.5 million cut, just under 40 teachers last year, getting great results efficiently. So I'll ask you, which of those programs is not a priority moving forward in a time when the world needs all of our graduates to fill those gaps? We will tighten our belts however you provide that resource for us. If you want us to meet those needs the way that we have been steadily improving meeting those needs, we need about 2.5% per year consistently. We have, like every good business, set aside a 7% reserve to pay 2 months of payroll or a month and a half, and the rare chance that you cut some funding and we have to shore a year before we make additional cuts. That 1% proposal is a $5 million cut the first year and a $15 million cut the second year. For us, that's tough. We'll make it work like we have. We've cut the majority of the last 15 years to maintain program. But I encourage you to realize how successful we've been, how proactive we are for the future career force, and what it'll cost to continue that. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Law.
Thanks, David.
Superintendent Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Joseph E. Brown, Sr., Superintendent of Schools at Fairmont Area Schools, and I have with me Sue Nelson, our business manager since 2002. She has 31 years of school finance experience. Mr. Chairman, we do have two handouts. My remarks, and Sue has a detailed spreadsheet.
I'm for pleased. Members that may not have been at a previous meeting, Superintendent Brown is a former state senator in Iowa who chaired their education committee.
And I keep saying I have the best of both worlds, sir. I have an Iowa education and a Minnesota paycheck. So, but I'm pleased to have the opportunity to speak in support of Senate File 163. Fairmont Area Schools is a consolidated school district located in south-central Minnesota along the Iowa border. We have 120 faculty that serve 1,700 students. We have steady enrollment. 30 of our 120 faculty are non-tenured. We are a fourth-year QCOM school. 53% of our elementary students qualify for free or reduced lunch. We currently do provide free breakfast to all of our students, and we provide free activity passes for all of our secondary students. We currently have an operating levy of $1,008 per student. Fairmont is a very conservative school district. In 2011, Senators, we cut our budget by 9%, $1.5 million. We eliminated 40 jobs all across the board, administration, teachers, paraprofessionals, secretaries. I mentioned that we're a very conservative school district. I just want to point out that during the last contract negotiations with our faculty, we settled for a total package of 5.6% over 2 years. And this represents steps and lanes for all teachers that qualified under QComp to move a step or a lane, a 1% increase to the teachers at the top of the salary schedule that had been frozen for multiple years, and a 0.75% increase on the salary schedule for the second year of a contract, and $928 for single-family health insurance increase. Well, this is the time of year that school districts are drafting budgets for the next school year and looking down the road. We need to make assumptions on the level of state aid, and we also need to make assumptions on what our student enrollment is going to be in September. At Fairmont, we develop a multi-year budget for 5 years, and we use these budget projections as we develop our staffing levels for teachers and support staff and as we prepare for teacher and principal negotiations. Tuesday night after our board meeting, we had a town meeting in Fairmont with our school board. We had 50 residents that showed up. We had a great two-hour discussion about kind of the future as we look down the road for the next 5 years. And so I mentioned that Sue Nelson is with us today, and Sue has put together three spreadsheets. It's actually six sheets of paper, and I'll kind of explain a little bit what they are, and then she'll look into detail. But the key number, if you look at these spreadsheets, the fourth item from the very bottom on every page, there's a category called unassigned fund balance. That's kind of the cash reserve left. And it shows the impact of what a 1% increase on the formula would be. That is the governor's current proposal. What a $300 increase would be. That's the Senate File 163. And what a 3% increase on a fiscal year 16 and fiscal year 17, which would be Senate File 163, as amended. So it shows the fiscal impact of our district of what happens. And I'll let Sue kind of work through the spreadsheet a little bit.
Well, Sue Nelson, business manager, Fairmont Schools. The spreadsheet is very detailed, and I won't go all the way through it. But as Superintendent Brown mentioned, this is a multi-year budget document. We start with our current year, and then we just roll it forward. And so the document basically assumes no increases in programs and nor any decreases in programs. So a snapshot of where we're at right now, and then making those assumptions on the revenue side and on the expenditure side. As you mentioned, the first sheet shows the governor's proposal of 1% increase on the formula. And then what we did on the expenditure side, it's a 2% increase in wages and benefits. And that's, you know, a pretty modest increase on wages and benefits, as Superintendent Brown mentioned what we did our last cycle. So looking at that, we still, in 4 years, are in the red. So on the flip side of that is basically everything the same except a 3% increase in wages and benefits. Well, at that point in time, we're $2 million.
Senator Chamberlain?
I'm sorry, question. Could you show me on the spreadsheet where you're pointing at again? I'm a little slow here.
If you have the staple in the upper left. Okay. And then on the upper right, it says what? The first one says governor's proposal 1% formula.
Right.
And then the 2% on our wages and benefits. Right. And then on the very bottom on the left, the fourth number from the bottom, it says unassigned.
Right.
That would be that unassigned fund balance.
Okay.
So then we go through all the, then there's five columns. We have our current fiscal year, so FY15 all the way through FY19.
You might want to write down unassigned fund balance.
So currently we're looking at ending our fund balance at $2.7 million. With this first scenario of a 1% increase on formula and 2% on wages and benefits, we would end FY16 at $2.6 million, the following year at $2.3 million, the following year at $1.3 million, and the following year at $500,000 in the red. Okay. So the flip of that sheet shows then a 3% increase in wages and benefits. And moving into teacher negotiations, our teachers see what that fund balance is. I mean, we'll work hard to keep it as low as we can, but looking at what 3% would do for us, you know, at the end of FY19, we'd be $2 million in the hole. The next sheet shows the $300 pupil unit increase in FY16 only and a 2% increase in wages and benefits and what that looks like. The flip of that is if we would have a 3% increase in wages and benefits. And then the third sheet shows the $300 pupil unit increase for both fiscal years 16 and 17, 2% increase and 3%.
Just a couple of other comments. I realize as a former legislator myself that public policy decisions have a financial impact on local school districts. And in order to fully implement three of the recent pieces of legislation that the legislature has approved, the teacher evaluation system, the World's Best Workforce, and the Safe and Supportive Schools Act, Fairmont Area Schools did adjust our administrative and support staff. I just want to point out on the second page of my handout, we have two buildings. We have 900 students in our elementary school and 800 in our secondary school. Both buildings have two full-time principals. Both buildings have a full-time dean of students, a full-time social worker, and a full-time nurse, and our high school has two counselors. Now, the two principals, their almost exclusive role is curriculum and instruction, teacher evaluation, making sure that our teachers are teaching the curriculum and making sure that we're meeting or exceeding the Minnesota standards. The dean of students, social worker, nurse, and our two counselors of the high school, their entire role is to work with kids and work with children issues. And so the fact that we were fortunate to be able to pass an increase in our operating levy from $500 to $1,008 a few years ago, that gave us the opportunity to fully fund the programs that we needed to implement current legislation. And by the way, we support all of those three pieces of legislation, the teacher evaluation, the World's Best Workforce, and, of course, the Safe and Supportive School Act. But we thought it'd be nice to show, because we're pretty typical. We're not a big school, but there's many, many schools across the state that are just like us. We have stable enrollment. We're a very conservative district in terms of how we budget our budget. Sue does a great job as our business manager, making sure that she budgets correctly and keeps me in line. And I guess the story is, you know, without adequate funding, I don't know if there's any school in our state that isn't going to be in deficit within 3 or 4 years. So that's why we fully support Senate File 163 as amended.
Thank you, Superintendent Brown and Ms. Nelson. Scott Kronquist.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. The two teachers that from Farmington need to go to a 10:30, so I'm going to bring those two up
please
to testify. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to address this committee. My name is Kendra Katoff, and I'm a special education teacher in Farmington. And we are just here today in support of both Senate File 163 and Senate File 541. Both bills provide an increase to the general education funding formula, and we have seen that the state has made significant investments in preschools through high schools over the past 2 years, and it is making a difference for our students. But despite these investments, they don't erase what has happened in the decade prior to that. And our per pupil formula hasn't kept up with inflation. Senate File 541 also includes an annual inflationary increase to the general formula. And tying the formula to inflation gives districts some stability and gives us some predictability and helps when we're making our budget decisions every spring. And this will particularly be helpful in odd number years when we're crafting our school budgets. And schools are then left in limbo until May or later as they wait to see how much or if any state aid that they will receive.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Island, and I teach science at Bachman Middle School in Farmington. I'm also the president of the Farmington Education Association. And thank you so much for the opportunity of being able to speak today.
What was the name of the school?
Bachman Middle School.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
So I just have some anecdotal things that I just wanted to add today to Kendra's statement, and that is, you know, that a lot of times in the spring when we're preparing for the budget, we don't exactly know how many dollars we'll have to work with for the fall, and so this will definitely help us to prepare and to be able to look forward to the fall and make fewer adjustments in the fall when our students come in. We would be able to keep staff that we have mentored throughout the previous years. Therefore, we'd have fewer layoffs and fewer programming changes. And some of the things that come to mind, obviously, would just be taking care of our students who have special needs as well, and giving them the educational supports that they need to be successful. Obviously, class sizes also come into that so that we are able to manage the students that we have in our classrooms. So we just know that having additional funding for programs and services, we know that'll work out for well for us. And an adequate formula increase will allow students to invest in teacher quality and hire more counselors and other support staff to help our students learn. And we all know the shortage that we have of counselors in our schools and how that is so important that we're able to increase that ratio for our students. So thank you very much for your time and for the privilege of being able to be here today.
Thank you very much. And members, we will go past 10:30 in respect to the testifiers that are here, and we'll be here till about 10:50 at the latest. If we do get through the testimony and we have a little time left, I do see that there's guests here from FFA or the Day at the Capitol, and if any of those members would like to just identify who they are, why they're here, I would offer that opportunity for those remaining. Okay, Scott, excuse me, Mr. Kroonquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and I do have a handout that I think Ms. Snyder is going to hand out right now. And I'll be very brief, Mr. Chairman. In fact, I really just want to go over this handout with you. It looks like this, and it's coming around. And, you know, at first blush, these two proposals might appear fairly aggressive, right? I mean, they do have a hefty price tag, and we might think, wow. But I think if you look at this handout, you can see actually that you could argue that these are pretty modest proposals in terms of where we, how much ground we have lost to inflation since 2003. The chart shows you, the bottom line shows you where we are today. We call it the net formula allowance, and the reason is the statutory formula allowance right now is $58.31 per pupil. However, that included an adjustment in 2013. You may recall we had big pupil weighting changes. So $424 of that adjustment was revenue neutral for school districts, just to adjust for the pupil weights. Now, if you look at the other two lines, it shows where that formula allowance would be today had it kept pace with inflation. The middle line uses the CPI as the inflationary index. The top line uses the implicit price deflator for state and local governments, which actually, we would argue, is the appropriate inflation index to measure the inflationary pressures on school districts. So, again, Mr. Chairman, it's quite clear how much ground we've lost to inflation. We think if we tied the inflation going forward to inflation, we wouldn't see this happen to our school districts. But I'll stop there and let you get on to the rest of the testimony, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kroonquist, and for the graph. Next.
All right.
Welcome.
Thank you, and thanks
again. Welcome
back. Yeah, welcome back. Chair Wieger and committee members, again, I'm Jane Barron, superintendent of Rosemont Apple Valley Egan Schools. And with me today, I'm joined by Jeff Solomon, and he is our director of finance and operations. And then we also have a parent resident, Charles McCready, from our school district that would like to testify.
Great.
First, though, we'd really like to thank you all for the funding we received in the last legislative funding session, 1.5% in 2014 and 2% for fiscal year 2015. This level of funding, along with a voter-approved operating levy increase to our existing levy dollars and previous cuts, have helped our district to maintain programs through inflationary pressure. Since becoming superintendent in 2009, the school district received 2 years of 0% in the formula, the 2 years of 1%, then 2 years of 1%, only half the rate of inflation. So like many districts throughout the state, this lack of even inflationary increase required our district to request additional referendum support from our community to simply maintain our existing programming. The original intent of local referendum authority for school boards was to provide programs and services that were beyond the basic programming. We support Senate File 541 because it will allow districts to maintain the purchasing power intended by the legislation.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jeff Solomon, Director of Finance and Operations for the Rosemont Apple Valley Egan Public Schools. The request for a 4% increase to the basic funding formula during the next funding cycle will allow districts throughout the state to catch up with the accumulated loss of purchasing power that's occurred during the last decade. The chart provided with the AMSD handout available today demonstrates the ground school districts have lost over the course of the last decade without regular inflationary growth applied to the basic funding formula. In addition to the referendum referenced by Superintendent Behrens. Our district implemented nearly $34 million of budget adjustments, resulting in increased class sizes, reductions to our support staff and transportation services, and other program elimination. Through these actions and the approved referendum support of our community, we have maintained a modest 10% fund balance. However, we have not been able to bring back previous levels of service or introduce new programming for our students. Senate File 541 would allow us to move forward with current initiatives, such as increased programming for targeted preschool services.
Hello.
Thank you.
I am Charles McCready. My wife and I are residents of Apple Valley. We're parents of a fourth grader and a seventh grader in the district. And I'm here basically to give some testimony in support of this district bill and funding, at least at index levels, as I understand them. Why? Well, from a monetary standpoint, District 196 consistently makes the right choices for the students and for excellent education. I'm seeing that firsthand with my children. This district is fiscally conservative. I observe that they're consistently focused on what provides the best return for the students, for parents, and taxpayers at large with the funds that are available. So I enthusiastically support full funding of education through effective school districts like 196. From a parent volunteer perspective, my experience in District 196 are terrific. On the first day my wife and I walked into our neighborhood Diamond Path School of International Studies, one of the three magnet schools in the district, we have been so taken by the spirit, the openness, the collaborative process that teachers and staff enable for our children and their growth and learning. My wife and I grew up in basic private education elsewhere, northern Minnesota and in Massachusetts. We are now convinced that the District 196 are our best option, having looked at private schools and seeing exactly what happens in public education in District 196. Since we're retired, we have the opportunity to volunteer in many ways, and what fantastic enjoyment working with the children. This on-site experience further enhances our enthusiasm for the learning process and that the district provides for the children of our communities. Our experience is not just limited to Diamond Path, however. We see the same positive enthusiasm producing attributes at the other elementary schools in the district that we visit. Moreover, we are witnessing the enhanced experience with our daughter attending Falcon Ridge Middle School. We're confident that the positive experience can continue through high school for both of our children, as long as the very effective programs that are in place now can be maintained through adequate and appropriate funding. Thank you for listening and your consideration. I appreciate the opportunity to express our support for the purpose of these bills.
Thank you, Mr. McCready, and representatives of Rosemont, Apple Valley, Egan.
Thank you.
Mr. Hine.
I'm Greg Hine, Executive Director of Business with Elk River Schools. Thank you, Chair Wieger and members of the committee. I will try to keep my comments brief in light of the time constraints that we have here. I'd reiterate what AMSD and the other groups are saying in regards to inflation, also according to a measure of inflation and information I got from my esteemed colleague and friend, Dr. Tom Melcher, who I had the pleasure of working with for 6 years at the Department of Education. Even if we have the $300 increase to the formula, it only brings us about halfway back to where we were in 2003. And clearly, the state economy and state's finances have improved substantially. Businesses have improved substantially since 2009. So the compound effect of underfunding versus inflation over time is profound. We've had to increase class sizes significantly. We've had to reduce programming. We've had to delay purchases of technology and textbooks and materials. We're pretty well tapped out. We've used all of those aces up our sleeve. They're gone now. So going forward, just to maintain what we have, we need to see at least an inflationary increase to the overall amount of funding. And a less spoken, more insidious type of thing is with regards to the labor negotiations. Some staff are moving through the schedule and getting step and lane increases, but most of them are not. they're at the top of the schedule or they have moved through their schedule, particularly non-teacher bargaining units. It puts real pressures on the district and its staff going to the table knowing that we don't have funding to provide any increase that would not allow for them to improve their financial condition, but just to maintain their existing purchasing power. That creates a real morale issue with a lot of the staff. It's very difficult when we keep asking them to do more and more and more and do better and better, and they have. But if you keep going back and saying, well, thanks, but here, continue to do what you're doing, do it more, do it better, yet we can't afford to even allow you to maintain your existing purchasing power, that makes it very difficult. So we strongly support, you know, increases to the formula, indexing to inflation, providing more adequate funding for schools, and at least to get us back to where we were, if not improve. And first time in over 20 years that I've been involved in this business, if this bill or something close to what would pass, to sit down and have a discussion, what can we add to the equation? It's never been the case. So that would be fantastic. I would greatly look forward to that day, and I'm sure all of my co-workers back at the district would concur with that.
Thank you, Mr. Hine. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to address this issue on formula and inflation increase? Questions, comments briefly from the committee, and we'll obviously have a lot of additional opportunity on this as well, and I know, but Senator Pratt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of things. First of all, let me just say I'm encouraged that with this proposal, I think we have bipartisan opposition to the governor's education proposal and a 1% funding increase. So for those who say we can't work together, I think we've just just proven that. But my question is, a few weeks ago, the Senate DFL rolled out a very aggressive plan with about $500 million in universal pre-K. Senator Hoffman, that was your proposal. School lunch program that was, depending on how you market, $30 to $60 million. My question is this supposed to be on top of that additional funding and those additional mandates, or are you expecting school districts to pay for those new mandates out of this increased funding?
Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, you and I served in former institutions called the school boards, and one thing we always would talk about, and there are some former legislators who have taught me well, saying, discuss the vision, show the problem, and you work your way down to some kind of soluble solution that makes sense for everybody. And when we're, if our conversation in the future is driven by Article 13 and assuring that every child is getting that free public education and every child is getting where they're going in Minnesota, then I think we're going to have some great bills this year, including early childhood and including, you know, formula increase. And depending upon, you know, again, at the end of the day, what it looks like. But you're right. It's a bipartisan work, and I'm looking forward to the continued conversation as we get more of these bills out in front of us.
Mr. Chair.
And members, I'll remind you, we'll have an ample opportunity for the overall debate on what's proposed ultimately in our budgets. But Senator Chamberlain.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. But you didn't directly answer that question, Senator Hoffman, did you? Because the numbers I added up here, your proposals come to over $1.5 billion unless you parse them out in some different way. We all support more, we all believe in more support for the schools because our proposal came with no strings attached per pupil, which was equal across the state. So we believe in that and we agree to that. As Senator Pratt had mentioned, there's support for some way to fulfill that vision, but the vision you have seems to lack a lot of real overall policy, you know, perception here and how we deal with this. Ours comes with no strings, equal across the state. Yours is a $1.5 billion with all these different numbers and various packages with no larger discussion of policy and how we implement this. $1.5 billion current biennium, of course, the tails are enormous in this sort of thing. So we want to fund the schools, but the schools are also burdened by a lot of access mandates and regulations and requirements imposed upon them by this body. So I'd encourage a larger discussion about that policy and encourage all the supporters of the increased dollars to do that as well, because I don't know how long we think we can continue going on this path. But thank you.
Sarah Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm no CPA, but I can do basic math. And Senator Chamberlain is right. It depends on which numbers you want to use here, but you're anywhere from between these two proposals and what the Senate DFL majority talked about a couple of weeks ago. You're at either $1.25 or $1.5 billion. That's the surplus plus some. So between the two, we're already into deficit, and we haven't yet touched health and human services, higher education, transportation, public safety, the DNR. So it's a little, quite frankly, it's a little hard to take it all as a package particularly seriously. But to move into something where maybe we can have some more bipartisan serious discussions, I'm going to ask about the base funding. And I'll ask the two authors. You're putting the money into the basic formula. We saw the governor's budget proposed, what was it, a week ago, 2 weeks ago, whenever that was, and he put 1% on the base, smaller than what you're looking at, but the same approach. And we saw with his numbers that the result of that, by putting the money into the base, for example, Minneapolis and St. Paul received 21% more than the statewide average. Their schools receive 21% more than the average school district across the state. My question to the authors is, in your proposal, is there any reform that will address that inequity, that will help school districts like North Branch, I don't know if they're still here, which I represent, to not fall further behind in the state funding because of the way our formula works and what happens when you put money on the base without making any kind of reform in that. Do you do anything, or is it just going to be status quo and we're going to continue to see that disparate funding grow farther apart?
Senators Hoffman or Claussen?
Mr. Chair and Senator, you know, you raise a question that, you know, I sat for 8 years on a school district that if we would have got just the average metro per pupil, we would have got $26 million more. I sat and argued because of the equalization factor. You come from a property poor district. Equalization factor is an issue in there. The bill that I'm sponsoring merely says we're going to go $300 per pupil, you know, has the formulas written. Now, you're also factoring in the compensatory integration aid. You know, there's a whole bunch of mix of dollars that get certain districts to the level where they're at. If we want to have a deeper in-the-weeds policy discussion, I'm ready to go on that one anytime. But simply for what we're doing here today is to really say, no, let's get this on the per pupil unit formula and let's get moving forward. And that's where we're at.
Mr. Chair, just to respond, because it is a per pupil funding, you know, all districts will get the same amount per pupil. And as Senator Hoffman said, there's lots of other things, specialized funding that goes to different districts based upon the makeup of the student population and their community. So we're just looking at an increase on that per pupil funding. And because Minneapolis, St. Paul, District 196 have more students, they're going to get more money than what North Branch is going to get. But I think what it does give more equity across the board, because now all districts are getting that increase on the formula. And I think that's, as you've heard today, that's pretty important.
Pretty important.
Sarah, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the fact of the matter is, when you put the money on the basic formula and it goes into our financing calculations and you kick in all the categoricals, you get, quite frankly, winners and losers. Some schools get more per child than other schools do. And that's the concern that I have been trying to raise in the discussion. Senator Hoffman, I would love to have the in-the-weeds policy discussion. That was a large purpose of the proposal that we announced a couple of days ago. The reality is, when you put it on the base, it kicks in all the categoricals and the funding formula that about four people in the state understand how it works, kicks out numbers at the end, and they're not the same for everyone. And I'll go back to what Senator Hoffman highlighted in the Constitution. And if you are putting money into a system that gives more over here and not as much over here, and we continue to do that and continue to do that and continue to do that, we do not build a uniform system. We build a disparate system. And unless we can make some changes and reforms in how we approach education funding and spending, we're not going to get back towards that uniformity. And I hope we can do that by the end of the session.
And members, we'll have a very robust discussion when we will be considering your bill, which was just introduced as well, but as to whether this body wants to decouple the per pupil allocation from compensatory and other programs that not only impact St. Paul or Minneapolis, but many rural communities, et cetera. We'll discuss that and what the impact, and we'll discuss that. So, Senator Kiffmeyer, and I would like to provide an opportunity, too, for the students that are here if they want to just talk about their day at the Capitol.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I look forward to our FFA students as well. But I just want to call your attention to the actual spreadsheet, which demonstrates clearly the difference that this does. So it's not subjective. It's by the spreadsheet that comes out here that shows. Because if indeed it were net equal to every student, it would show it on the spreadsheet. It shows clearly that it is not. My school districts are in the bottom 20%. Matter of fact, one of my school districts is the bottom. And so clearly this bill only worsens in the way it is structured, that whole situation. And if you continue with that year upon year upon year, right now it's about my school districts get about half of what the top does. And we aren't even close to state average. That would be great news indeed, as you said, Senator Hoffman. But we just can't continue to do this. Constitutionally, I believe that's a real serious question, but the spreadsheet shows here what we are saying. So thank you, Mr.
Yes,
Chairman.
It's
and I know
noted.
You want to get to the students.
And we are
going to
hear Senate File 604 as well on Tuesday. And
yes.
Okay, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hoffman, I have to concur with Senator Chamberlain. I don't know that we got an answer on if you expect to pay for this out of the per pupil funding or if this is an addition. But I think my additional comment would be to the inflator. I think it's an interesting idea, and I know one school districts would like. My concern is, and I don't know this is much of a question as a comment, that we seem to put things on autopilot. We seem to be trying to lessen the burden on the legislature. This is a decision I believe we should be making, that the inflator, as it's written, exceeds the level of inflation, and I understand that we need to catch up somewhat. You know, I look at this even longer than just 2004. I look at it back 25 years, where the average increase has been about $1.5 million. And when I was on the board, that was 1.5%, which was in excess of $2 million for my local district that we lost in purchasing power. So I certainly understand that, but I think it's a dangerous – we've set a precedent in the last biennium that we seem to be carrying on, that we want to put things on autopilot with inflators if you're looking at the minimum wage. We want to put things in the hands of unelected boards like we have with the Met Council, with the School Climate Center, with the Minsure Board, that we seem to be trying to relieve ourselves of our legislative responsibility, and I think that's – that's something that concerns me.
Okay, Senators Hoffman and Claussen, 30 seconds apiece for a close.
Well, I think our legislative responsibility is lost a long time ago, Senator Pratt, because we don't fund to the level we should for our schools based upon our constitutional responsibility. Instead, what we've done is pass that on to the local levies, and we know that that's where a great disparity comes into because some can afford that, others cannot. And so what we're attempting to do here is to increase the formula, provide the adjustment for the cost of living so that we do have a little bit better idea about funding our schools equitably so they have an idea of the future on the types of funding that they can look forward to and they can develop budgets. You heard some very compelling testimony today about the financial status of our districts. You've also heard over the last several weeks some great things that are happening in our schools. And if we expect those great things to continue, then we better make sure we fund it. Very briefly, Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, and I'm only going to take 45 minutes of your time on my last remarks. I'm kidding. Seriously, this opens up a great conversation, and I'm glad to hear, you know, ex-school board members sitting around this table wanting to go deeper in the weeds and have discussions. And I would hope that we can turn this into a deeper and broader discussion on funding, period. But for now, let's keep this thing alive, and I'd like to get the FFA students up here too with Senator Weber, and they can say how they're doing, how their day's going. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Klassen, I'll testifier Senate File 163 is man be laid over for possible inclusion. Senate File 541 will be laid over for possible inclusion. And we want to thank the members of the FFA that are here today for their day at the Capitol. I know that Senator Weber used to proudly wear that jacket, I believe. And Senator Weber, would you perhaps like to segue on memory lane? And we'll ask any students that would like to come to the table just to introduce themselves. And you don't have to give a speech. You don't have to say anything. But if you would like to tell us who you are, we would love to have that in the public record. But I'll yield first to Senator Weber, who's...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm really pleased to see the FFA members here today. FFA was that element in high school that actually gave me an opportunity to see the world beyond my local home and school district and community. And my involvement is as far as being a chapter president for 2 years, winning the state creed speaking contest and the state public speaking contest were great opportunities for me, as well as serving 4 years on the meat judging team, I might add.
Okay.
And so, but anyway, it's a great thing. I enjoy every time that they manage to come up to the Capitol. So thank you. I'll turn it over to them now.
Okay. You're in charge now.
I'm Chelsea Swanson. I am the treasurer for the Bram FFA chapter.
Where are you from?
Bram.
Okay.
And we're just glad that we got to come down here and listen to what's going on in our government and stuff like that. We are a new chapter, so we're getting our chapter rolling again after 25 years, so we're just glad we could come down here.
And you're great, and then if each of you, if you'd like, just share what you might want to do when you graduate.
I'm in 10th grade. I'm not quite sure what I want to do. I want to stay on the agricultural path, but I don't exactly know if that's going to happen or not.
Okay, well, you're off to a great start here. Okay.
I'm Kaylee Carlson. I'm also in 10th grade. After I graduate, I want to become a nurse practitioner.
And where are you from?
Bram.
Great. Okay.
My name is Emma Downing, and I'm an 8th grader at Bram High School, and I'm looking into going into being a music major when I graduate.
I love it.
Wonderful. Okay. And we have others in the audience that may like to, anyone else?
Come on.
Get an extra point. You get an extra point. Your day at the Capitol.
You can probably do better than that.
Okay.
I'm Michael McAdams. I am also from Bram High School. What I want to do after I graduate is either start a farm or be in agricultural sciences.
Wonderful. Thanks. And we have perhaps anyone else with the program that would like to say...
Hello. And don't ask me to try on my jacket any longer.
Hi.
I'm Lilia Anderson, and I'm also from Bram. I'm an 8th grader.
Welcome. Have you thought about the future after you graduate?
A little bit. I'm not quite sure.
Okay. Any of you have advice for us? You know, you're going to be meeting with your legislator and the rep and the senator, but just thoughts in terms of the state of education?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll be meeting with them as soon as we adjourn this committee. They're constituents of mine.
Okay. Well, very good. I'm sure Senator Nienau will reflect those ideas, but we'll give you a chance now if you'd like to rehearse. key message, I think things are going well. And okay, and if you were in charge, would you change anything regarding our testing or the school year requirements? All's good? All right. Okay. Well, thank you. It's very brave of you. I couldn't have done that myself. And you're the future. We understand that. So thanks for being here today. Members, that concludes our business. For next week, we have a full agenda. I know there was over
10 introductions today, and so we're working to get everything included. We may have to go to a couple of evening meetings, and I, for those of you that are here, I'll get your input. Do you have a preference to go to the evening if we have to, or a meeting on a Monday or Friday?
Evening.
Evening. Okay, so that would probably be the where we would go, and if it was evening, we'd probably go more toward Tuesday or Wednesday, particularly for Greater Minnesota, where you have to get back to your district. So, there being no further business, the committee is adjourned.
Hey, thank you.